Okay, thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, I have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you for your comments, and author and academic Lawrence Davidson there with his comments. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. For me, Mikhail Vitale, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The top stories in a message to the UN. Iran's president warns about the consequences of Israel's settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yemeni officials warn of a worsening humanitarian crisis in the war-torn country, saying a child dies every 10 minutes there. Also ahead, the United States registers over 2,500 new deaths from the novel coronavirus and more than 180,000 infections. Welcome to the program. Iran's president has reiterated his country's full support for the Palestinian people and called for a united global front to counter Israel's violation of international law. Hassan Rouhani made the call in an address to the UN General Assembly on the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Rouhani accused Israel of racism and organized crime against Palestinians and condemned its blockade of the Gaza Strip, especially at the time of the coronavirus pandemic. The Iranian president warned about the dangerous regional and global security consequences of Israel's settlement construction in the occupied West Bank and Judaization of Jerusalem al-Quds. He denounced the recent normalization deals between some Arab states and Tel Aviv as betrayal of the Palestinian cause, as well as Israel's repeated violations of the Syrian and Lebanese sovereignty. Media reports say a leading Israeli lawmaker has presented a new plan to parliament to further expand settlement activities in the West Bank and the Jordan Valley. The plan also includes measures to establish a number of industrial zones and expand tourism on the Palestinian lands. Mona Candil reports.
As part of Israel's land grabbing and illegal settlement expanding policies in the occupied West Bank, Israeli media have reported that a Knesset committee member and senior Likud member Nir Barkat has presented a plan to the Knesset to further expand settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and the Jordan Valley. According to the plan, Israel needs to establish some industrial zones and expand tourism in the areas.
Nir Barkat is one of the establishment, this fanatic Zionist establishment, that they are behind this colonial project. So what he did is not, he's saying, and what he offered is not something new. It's part of the whole Zionist plan, colonial plan that's already going on the ground. When we talk this year about 15,000 housing units that has been issued, this is double than the last year.
Barakat has also announced that Israel aims to settle 2 million Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. This comes after contacts took place between settlers and Barakat himself over the past few days. Experts say to make this available, Barakat has put a plan to tighten Israel's grip on the Palestinian lands, adding that the Israeli regime will have to approve these plans before the inauguration of the next U.S. administration on 20 January 21 to make sure they will be applied.
Israeli parties are using the remaining period of Trump administration to carry out an ethnic cleansing project, first in Jerusalem al-Quds and then in the occupied West Bank. Tel Aviv wants to restrict Palestinians in their villages and at the same time to control their surrounding areas without official declaration of annexation.
During the four-year period of U.S. President Donald Trump, settlement activity has more than doubled, as the number of plans approved by Netanyahu's regime increased 2.5 times compared to the previous 4 years.
For years, Israeli authorities have continued to facilitate the expansion of illegal settlements in Palestinian territories. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Mona Kandil, in front of the Israeli settlement of Beit Il, occupied Ramallah.
Bahrain's top cleric has denounced the Al Khalifa regime's decision to normalize ties with Israel. In a statement, Sheikh Isa Qasem said the Manama regime has broken with the people of Bahrain to win the United States' favor. His statement came as a Bahraini government delegation arrived in Israel to hold talks on boosting economic and tourism cooperation with the regime. Bahrain and the UAE signed U.S. broker deals aimed at normalizing ties with Israel in mid-September. The moves have drawn widespread condemnations from the Muslim world, especially from the Palestinians. People of Palestine call the agreements a betrayal of their cause and a stab in their back. The Yemeni Health Ministry says a child dies every 10 minutes in the country as shortfalls in aid funding are worsening the humanitarian crisis there.
More than 45% of children under 5 years old are malnourished. More than 2.5 million children are malnourished, including 500,000 suffering from acute malnutrition, which means if they don't get urgent care, they will die. A child like these dies every 10 minutes.
According to the UN, acute malnutrition rates among Yemeni children under the age of 5 are the highest ever recorded. Last month, the World Body warned that Yemen is in imminent danger of the worst famine that the world has witnessed in decades. The Arab country has seen much of its infrastructure devastated in a Saudi-led war that started in early 2015. The aggression, in tandem with a crippling blockade, has pushed Yemen to the brink of what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, have been killed in the Saudi-led war. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the international community is neglecting the plight of the Yemeni people.
Saudi Arabia doesn't want to lose face. It doesn't want to be defeated by a poor country. It also has the backing of the United States. The United States provides it with weaponry. It likes to use what it has and test these weapons, and it's testing them on human victims in Yemen. What it will take for the world community to finally say no is difficult to understand, because what more needs to be seen? The constant death, suffering of children, dying by bombs, by starvation. Even if some of these children who are starving now are able to get assistance or able to get food, the developmental challenges that they will have will remain with them throughout their lives. This is an extremely serious and extremely sad situation, and the the world community, the United Nations, are neglecting their responsibilities. The United States, of course, is complicit in all these crimes.
To another one of our headline stories this hour, the U.S. has recorded more than 2,500 coronavirus deaths in 24 hours. That is the highest daily toll since late April. The figure was reported by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday. It registered over 180,000 new infections the same day. According to the university, the number of hospitalizations hit 99,000. That's a record, too. The situation is dire in several Midwestern states, including Indiana and South Dakota. Experts fear a new surge in infections several days after the Thanksgiving holiday that saw millions of Americans travel. Total COVID cases in the U.S. are now above 13.7 million. Deaths have exceeded 270,000. Both are the highest in the world. Let's check out those figures and numbers, including the latest, through the help of our man Wyatt Reed, who's standing by for us and comes to you live out of Washington, D.C. via Skype. Wyatt, tell us what we know.
Well, as we see with this latest horrific number, just really an incalculable loss, just to put that number in perspective, 2,500 deaths, that's more than the number of people killed in the 9/11 terror attacks, for which the United States has obviously spent so much used to justify the government used to spend so much time and so much energy off in the Middle East. Meanwhile, we see these kinds of just bodies sort of piling up. You know, it's not just the North. It's not just the coasts, right, that were first hit that are being affected, although, of course, they are with this advent of this much-feared third wave. We see in the Northeast field hospitals that were erected in Rhode Island admitted their first patients today, and in nearby Worcester, Massachusetts, the National Guard erected another field hospital. But, of course, in the Midwest, we find throughout this large region, really a dozen or so states, Ohio, the Dakotas especially, Kansas, people just have nowhere to go. We're back at square one, essentially, where there are simply not enough resources to go around to treat the people who need treatment. So people are simply going to die. That's the sad reality, and that's what we're facing in the U.S. today.
You know, Wyatt, one might legitimately ask the question of how well are you seeing this thing has been managed from the get-go, as well as the fact that it's only just a couple of days back that Thanksgiving was held, and that contributed, so far as I've read, you know, greatly to these figures and numbers. What's the word on that?
Well, of course, we're seeing from the get-go really a broad trend of inability and unwillingness to treat the pandemic from the top to the bottom, from the federal government to the state government to the local level. There has been just an unwillingness from a political perspective in many instances, and then an inability in many others to seriously treat this disease, to actually marshal the requisite material resources that are needed to prevent a kind of catastrophe that we're witnessing today. And of course, this larger trend of refusing to go along with the Thanksgiving guidelines in many cases, that's contributing to it. But of course, we have to understand that from the get-go, there has been no real state response, no real accountability or responsibility on that end, and it's all been on the individual. So it's easy to understand why so many people would say at this point, you know, I just want to see my family. I've been cooped up for a year. And of course, you know, we're still weeks away from any vaccines being given out to the first line responders. So we're about to see just how bad it can get, I think.
All right, 2,562 exact number of the people who have lost their lives to COVID-19 in the past 24 hours. That's the lives of people we're speaking about. Thank you very much. That's Wyatt Reed, our man in Washington, D.C., with that update. The U.S. Justice Department says there is no proof of widespread fraud in the November 3rd presidential vote, further dimming Donald Trump's hopes of re-election. Attorney General William Barr said the department has not found fraud on a scale substantial enough to revoke Joe Biden's projected victory in the race. This is while Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, slammed Barr's remarks, accusing the Justice Department of failing to conduct proper probes. Giuliani vowed that the president's team will continue its legal fight. On Monday, Arizona and Wisconsin certified Biden's win, becoming the last of the six battleground states to do so. Trump insists that he won the race for the White House, but is being cheated out of victory. Colin Campbell says that U.S. President Donald Trump's claim of widespread fraud in November 3rd elections are only taken seriously by his diehard fans.
And this is something that he's asserted after weeks of pretty much reporters and other officials saying that this is the conclusion that would inevitably happen, that the president really had no justification or evidence of their being rampant voter fraud across the country, that there are dead people voting, that there were illegal registrations, that the whole system is corrupt. All of this was said by the president to really electrify his base, that there was some wrongdoing and maybe to create some unrest that could help him stay in his position as president. But as we have observed, none of these processes or operations have been working for the president. He's really every day said that he's won the election, that the election is fraudulent, but there's been no evidence that's supporting any of this, and no one seems to be taking him seriously, except for maybe his diehard supporters. Other than that, most politicians are starting to accept that there's a transition happening. There are some Republicans who have been very quiet, but it's being reported that really they know deep down that the president lost the election, and they're just keeping quiet so as not to receive any wrath from the commander-in-chief. As we know, the president can be vindictive and vengeful. And I think that there are a lot of Republicans who are not showing or not exhibiting any bravery.
The U.S. Justice Department has opened an investigation into a possible criminal scheme to bribe White House officials for a presidential pardon. The probe was revealed to public and partially redacted court documents. The memos do not reveal any names or detail of the alleged plot. Washington, D.C. District Court has allowed prosecutors to view communications between an unnamed lawyer and clients for a secret lobbying scheme. President Trump recently pardoned his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who had pleaded guilty to lying to federal investigators during a probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. While as the UK prepares to exit its second COVID-19 lockdown, all hopes seem to be pinned on a vaccine to ward off any lockdown and make life go back to normal. However, one of the challenges of mass immunization is convincing people that a vaccine is safe, and the speed with which it is hitting the shelves is a source of concern. Bianca Rahimi is in London.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk. whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Two rising stars of the UK Conservative Party see Macron as a model which shows how deeply institutional Islamophobia is embedded in the party, says Peter Auburn Ryer in an article published under the heading Tory Party's Praise of Macron's Ugly Politics is Shocking. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In normal circumstances, French President Emmanuel Macron is regarded with dark suspicion in Boris Johnson's Brexiteering Conservative Party. This has dramatically changed over the last few weeks. The French president is in danger of turning into a Tory hero. The reason? His response to the recent atrocities in France. Macron's government unveiled a plan to close down the Collective Against Islamophobia in France, CCIF, the largest organization in France that monitors anti-Muslim hate crimes, even though CCIF has no connection to last month's attacks. The decision has been called shocking by Niels Mosenix, Europe Director at Amnesty International. This move could have a chilling effect on all people and organizations engaged in combating racism and discrimination in France, he said. The Muslim charity Baraka City, which likewise has no link to the attacks, has received the same treatment. President Macron has started to use inflammatory language of the kind usually associated with the far right. For example, he referred to the breeding grounds for terrorists in France in a letter to the Financial Times. When Middle East Eye approached the Elysee Palace, it failed to provide evidence to support the president's wild and apparently inaccurate assertion. Crucially, it is not Conservative Party headbangers who have been praising the French president for his response. Tom Tugendhat, chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee, increasingly tipped as a future Tory leader, has issued a series of tweets praising Macron's reaction. France's multiple attacks in recent days have drawn an inspiring response from Emmanuel Macron, Macron is defending equal rights for all. We must stand together and stand with France, he wrote in one tweet. This week, Neil O'Brien, MP, another rising star, who was recently appointed head of the new policy group in 10 Downing Street, expressed his admiration for Macron's reaction. Responding to a tweet from Labour MP, Zara Sultana, that raised concerns about Macron's decision to close CCIF, O'Brien tweeted, "A Labour MP smearing the French president as an Islamophobe for reasserting basic liberal values in the wake of a series of horrific attacks. Grim. We should support the French as they grieve in the wake of these atrocities." Both O'Brien and Tugendhat's unconditional praise of Macron is little short of extraordinary. And O'Brien's statement that Macron is standing up for basic liberal values is absurd. There is a wider context to Macron's recent statements and hardening of policy against Muslims. Rather than asserting liberal values, Macron appears to be trying to appeal to the far right. Recent polls have shown Macron is neck and neck with Marine Le Pen and her far-right National Rally Party. Many analysts see Macron's actions as a way to court right-wing voters in a bid to fend off his most dangerous rival for the presidency. This context makes it especially worrying that two mainstream Tory politicians have come out so publicly in favor of Macron. Remember how Theresa May responded to the terrible Manchester Arena bombing, which killed 23 people 3 years ago. She was low-key and measured. Certainly, there were a series of arrests and an increase in security, but May did not exploit this tragic and terrible event for electoral advantage. Indeed, campaigning for 2017 general election was suspended for 2 days after the attack. She certainly didn't echo the rhetoric of the far right, as Macron has done in France. Nor did she threaten to close down law-abiding Muslim organizations. The CCIF has no exact British equivalent, but it's as if May had made the Muslim Council of Britain illegal in the wake of the Manchester Arena bombing, even though it had nothing to do with the atrocity. Meanwhile, Macron's interior minister, Gérald Darmanin, has made a series of deeply provocative and sectarian remarks. He has accused the CCIF and other Muslim groups of being enemies of the Republic. This is the language of hate. Darmanin was widely criticized in October for expressing shock at halal food aisles while addressing the problem of separatism. Speaking to French TV, he said he had always been shocked to walk into a supermarket and see that there was an aisle of such community food. There is no question that Home Secretary Priti Patel is on the right of British politics, but she is yet to feel threatened by a halal supermarket aisle or accuse the Muslim Council of Britain of being an enemy of the British state. There is a major problem with Islamophobia at the grassroots level and among backbench conservative MPs. Last week, Michael Fabricant's warning to the Muslim Council of Britain that by exposing Islamophobia it was damaging Anglo-Muslim relations was an example of this and echoed President Macron's talk of Muslim separatism. When it comes to Muslims, President Macron has adopted the squalid policies of the far right. He has his own cynical reasons. He wants to win votes off Marine Le Pen. The fact that conservatives like O'Brien and Tugendhat should praise this low and ugly politics is shocking. It shows how deeply institutional Islamophobia has now become embedded in the governing Conservative Party.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, this is News Bulletin. My name's Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from London. We start now as more details begin to emerge into the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsin Fakhrizadeh. Leading security official Ali Shakhkani has revealed no individuals were present at the site of the attack. Rather, remotely controlled electronic devices were used in the assassination.
The operation was very complicated and was carried out by using electronic devices. No individual was present at the site. We have found clues and the person who designed the operation is known to us. We know who they are and what their background is. Definitely the MEK hypocrites had a role also. Definitely the criminal element of this action is the Zionist regime and Mossad.
Other reports suggest a remotely controlled car with a concealed machine gun and a self-destruct mechanism were used to carry out the operation. Israel has claimed previous attacks that killed three other nuclear scientists, but has declined to comment thus far. Iran's defense minister has vowed to continue the work of the scientists with, quote, more speed and more resilience. John White, the author and political commentator, is with us from Edinburgh. And John, the use of unmanned technology in this way suggests a rather large-scale operation. Your thoughts?
Good evening. Yes, a highly sophisticated operation, perhaps the most sophisticated we've ever seen of this kind, involving electronic equipment operated via satellite, we're being told, clearly carried out by a state, clearly carried out by the Israeli state and its notorious intelligence agency, Mossad, or a subunit within Mossad, and with the participation of the MEK terrorist organization in Iran. The great worry for the Iranians will be the extent to which security arrangements surrounding two of its most important officials have been breached this year, leading to their assassination. First, Qasem Soleimani in January, and now Mr. Fakhrizadeh just the other day. That's going to be a great worry, and it goes without saying that there will be a comprehensive review taking place of those security arrangements within Iran as we speak. But this operation has far-reaching consequences for geopolitical relations between Iran and the West. The fact that there's been no condemnation of any serious kind from any Western government is proof positive that the Israeli exceptionalism continues to be a bane in the region and in the wider world. Where are the economic sanctions? Where is the expulsion of ambassadors? Any of the measures that would be levelled at Iran if Iranian security had carried out the assassination of Israeli scientists in Israel, for example?
You mentioned right there the silence on this issue to an extent, because there have been murmurings coming out of Brussels and, of course, London. But this idea that there should be restraint as we wait to find out what happened on almost a both sides of the argument issue here, where does that leave you, John?
Well, it's hypocritical in the extreme. Words of condemnation are one thing, but fine words butter no parsnips. As I just said, we need to see sanctions. We need to see the expulsion of ambassadors. We need to see Israel held to account for its repeated criminal actions. And the fact that it keeps getting away with this only encourages it to undertake more criminal actions of this kind. It's a violation of international law, human rights. It was murder, foul murder, carried out in violation of any code of ethics worthy of the name. And I'm very concerned that nobody from the incoming Biden administration has voiced any criticism of this action. John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, rightly described it as reckless and criminal, but we need to hear this from an incoming Biden administration with reset of relations with Iran surrounding its nuclear program in mind. If that doesn't happen, it's going to be very difficult for a Biden administration to have any credibility and to be trusted by the Iranian government with regard to its adherence to any such diplomatic efforts that it may try to undertake to get JCPOA back on track.
And very briefly here, John, does this act of terror constitute provocation?
It's a massive provocation, and it's designed to be one. And it does place the Iranian government in the invidious position of choosing whether to undertake immediate retaliation, which is entirely justified in doing, or to play the longer game, knowing that this could well be, as Mr. Rouhani rightly points out, a trap being set by the Israelis and by the Trump administration before it departs the stage.
Wise counsel, as always, thank you very much, John White. Now we move on to some other news here coming out of Germany, because at least two people have been killed and many more injured when a car plowed into civilians in the pedestrian area of the German city Trier earlier today. Eyewitness testimonies captured by local news outlets just moments after the crash have reportedly stated that passers-by flooded into nearby shops as the speeding car drove into crowds of people. Some have also claimed to have seen a pram being flung into the sky and seeing at least 30 people laying motionless on the streets. According to police, the suspect, a 51-year-old driver who resides within the Trier district, has been arrested, and the large vehicle he was driving has been seized pending further investigations. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has voiced growing security concerns over China's global rise at a meeting of the military alliance's foreign ministers.
China is not our adversary. Its rise presents an important opportunity for our economies and trade. We need to engage with China on issues such as arms control and climate change. But there are also important challenges to our security.
The comments will not have gone unnoticed in Beijing and would be seen as a continuation of the increasingly confrontational rhetoric the West has taken in regards to China. This following similar statements from the Trump administration and its European allies. As the UK prepares to exit its second national COVID-19 lockdown, all hope seem to be pinned on a vaccine to ward off another and perhaps bring life back to some semblance of normality. As the COVID-19 death toll rises to more than 1.4 million annual across the globe, governments are fast-tracking the approval of various vaccines, and millions of doses are on the verge of being shipped across the planet. However, one of the challenges of mass immunization is convincing people the vaccine is safe, and the speed with which these ones are hitting the shelves could be a source of concern, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of 7 different vaccines.
A mass inoculation programme is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With big differences still to be bridged on state aid and fishing, Britain and the European Union have warned each other that time is running out to reach a Brexit trade deal. The United Kingdom will completely sever ties with the European Union on the 31st of December, when a transition period of informal membership ends. This comes as massive divergences on fisheries and trade disputes still persist. Speaking on the EU-UK Brexit tensions, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has stated that many EU member nations were, quote, losing patience. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who's also tackling the worst official European COVID-19 death toll, has previously stated that a deal would be preferable for Britain, but the UK would be prepared for a no-deal Brexit in any event. Well, Jonathan Fryer, the author and commentator, is with us for this one. And Jonathan, will we get a deal? It seems this week is as late as we can push things.
Well, despite the rather fraught nature of the stop-start negotiations in the last few days, I'm actually feeling a little more confident that there will be a deal after all. Opposition parties in Parliament have started debate or discussing whether they're going to vote for it or against it or abstain, even though they don't have a text in front of them. And both sides in the talks have said they're prepared to talk right through this week, into the weekend, even beyond if necessary, because they really do want to try and find a deal. But that doesn't mean they necessarily will be able to overcome all of the outstanding issues.
Well, we've had Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking before about, you know, it being okay without a deal. Chancellor Angela Merkel is now saying that some EU leaders are losing patience. Is Britain going to just continue holding its bluff, holding its line clear here?
Well, I think the frustration felt by the EU 27 leaders is very understandable, because whereas Michel Barnier, the EU negotiator, has carried in out his side of the bargain in a very civilized, calm manner, the British side has been really quite aggressive, including from the Prime Minister, and have accused the Europeans of being the obstacle in the way of a deal, which is frankly not an objective appraisal of the current situation. And let's face it, the EU27 don't want Brexit. They never did. And several of the member countries, not least Ireland, are really going to suffer economically if indeed it goes ahead, and especially if it's a no-deal Brexit.
Well, I'm not asking you to be a betting man here, Jonathan, but what do you say are the chances of a no-deal at this stage, and where would that leave the Conservative Party going forward?
Well, I think it's probably now about 50-50, which is better than a couple of weeks ago. But as far as the Conservative Party is concerned, they will probably get a hit in the opinion polls early next year. But we have to remember they've got a majority of 80 in Parliament, so pretty safe. And they don't have to have another general election for another 4 years if they want. So Boris Johnson has time to ride this out, though rumours have it that he actually would quite like to step down early in the new year and hand the poison chalice over to somebody else.
Well, perhaps he can hold counsel with David Cameron and how that left his political career. Jonathan, thank you so very much. So some other news now, because as you might recall, over the summer, huge Black Lives Matter protests were held across the United States and all over the world in solidarity with Black Americans who are facing racial injustice. But in those subsequent months, have the words Black Lives Matter come to mean something entirely different? Well, this is the question Richard Sedan is asking in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
Over the summer of 2020, Black Lives Matter protests erupted over the US and around the world following the death of George Floyd. Anti-black racism and police violence in the US had restarted a new wave of protests, which first started in 2015 in Ferguson, following the killing of 18-year-old Mike Brown, a black man, by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Fast forward to 2020, and this time millions upon millions around the world marched in solidarity with black Americans, causing the whole world to side-eye America. This global attention became concerning to the powers that be, and so the slogan Black Lives Matter began to be attacked to divert focus away from why the protest began, which is racial injustice in America, which has existed as long as the country has.
Black Lives Matter is now more popular than the President of the United States.
Black Lives Matter is killing Americans.
So what do I think those riots are? I think they're depravity. I think they're thugs.
Right-wing media began intentionally using the term Black Lives Matter without distinguishing between those at the protests and Black Lives Matter, the organization. With no distinction made, criticisms of Black Lives Matter, the organization, de facto became attacks on all black people in much the same way as the phrases thug, calls for law and order, gang culture had become the codified language of the white media to describe black people without doing it directly, reinforcing racist stereotypes already deeply rooted in America. This linguistic trick of European colonialism isn't just found in America. We see these subtle forms of racism in the UK media too, with phrases like knife crime, gang culture, and so-called black-on-black crime routinely peddled by the racist press. Using the term Black Lives Matter to simply mean black people is another tactic. Next came the claim that George Soros, rather than the continual killing of black people in America, was somehow the sole cause of the Black Lives Matter protests. While Soros contributed money to Black Lives Matter, the organization, neither the organization nor Soros are behind the millions of people rallying for justice for black people. Again, the sole cause is systemic racial injustice and police killings, something white America and the media wants you to forget. Remember, the police in America were literally formed from slave-catching gangs and still exist to this day to maintain the racial hierarchy in America. The precedent of giving white people like Soros the credit for things done by black people is not a new trick. White people are given the credit for ending slavery, apparently discovering Africa and America, where black people had already traveled to, while telling us that aliens built the pyramids and that Jesus looked like Brad Pitt. Trust me when I say this, George Soros isn't responsible responsible for the protests in the United States. Also not responsible for the Black Lives Matter protests are so-called trained Marxists. While the founders of the Black Lives Matter organization in the US might identify as such, only a tiny minority of the many millions around the world who identify with the slogan Black Lives Matter are Marxist. All of these excuses are commonplace in the news. What you will never hear is the very blunt reality and cause of the protests. Ongoing continued racism in the US, massive levels of lethal violence towards the black community from policing and white terror groups the police often turned a blind eye to. Systemic racism at the heart of the United States, which has existed for more than 400 years, is not a broken system. It's the system working as it was meant and designed to do so. Those who benefit from this system will tell you anything to make you believe black protests are a conspiracy. There is no conspiracy. Systemic racism as a system of power in America is working as it was meant to. Those who benefit from it want to keep it that way. So, the next time you hear someone using the term Black Lives Matter without defining it, you can be sure that they simply mean all black people, and you know what they really mean.
So troubles down under as tensions brew between Australia and China. You can tell me all about it, Robert Indakesh.
Well, if you've been paying attention to the media in recent weeks and around a month ago, we saw a story emerge because of leaked documents out of the Australian military, which pointed out that Australian Special Forces teams had essentially killed 40 Afghan civilians in the most brutal ways you could imagine. But the Australian media is not mad so much about that. The Australian media is mad about the fact that China, in fact, a Chinese diplomat tweeted a cartoon which was created which depicted an Australian soldier killing an Afghan child. This is what the Australian Prime Minister had to say about this.
The Chinese government should be totally ashamed of this post. It diminishes them in the world's eyes. I want to make a couple of points about this. Australia is seeking an apology from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs from the Chinese government for this outrageous post.
So no ability to take any criticism we see there from the Australian side, trying to say that this was a doctored photo when clearly it was a cartoon. Anyone who looks at it can see that it's a cartoon. And this is criticism from a foreign government. And it doesn't seem that the Australian media as well, when we look at the Australian media and the way they've reacted to these two stories, they've went absolutely irate when it comes to this tweet. Which came out just a few days ago. But when it comes to the claims of their soldiers massacring Afghan civilians just for the fun of it, that seemed to be not quite as offensive to them, and they didn't really...
So let me
really
see if I get this right, Rob. It's not so much the claims that Australian troops were committing extrajudicial killings here in perhaps a conflict they have no business being in, but it's the fact that a Chinese diplomat flag this up in a cartoon. Am I missing a link here?
No, that's exactly what's happening here. I mean, even when you look at the case of these Australian soldiers, they've sent them notices, which they have 2 weeks to respond to. I believe 13 of them, these special forces people, were sent these notices. And essentially, they're saying that they'll be fired, but it will take years and years for it to even come to court. They probably will not be imprisoned for their crimes against humanity, which were committed in Afghanistan. No reconsidering of their role in Afghanistan, despite the fact that they've been there for 19 years and there's no reason for them being there. But they're just absolutely irate when it comes to these a depiction, I believe an accurate depiction, of what was happening in Afghanistan. So this is how they deal with foreign criticism. And it's funny that the Chinese said, because there's an ongoing sort of dispute between Australia and China, they said that they'll turn Australia into the white trash of Asia, which seems to be the way that they're reacting here, just thinking that they are the superpower behaving like it and trying to tell the Chinese that they can't criticize Australia when Australia is frequently criticizing China, and China has not behaved in this way.
Right. The online reaction to this should be interesting.
The first tweet we've got here is from Syrian Girl on Twitter. She says, "The image China tweeted about Australia isn't fake or doctored because it's a depiction. They're not saying this is an actual photo. What's actually fake is babies in incubators, children overboard, Syrian chemical weapon attacks. What's real is Australian soldiers shot civilians. We got another one here as well who says, a reasonable summation of the pic is that it is graphic but accurate in its depiction. We are getting the outrage. The outrage is not because Australians did commit such heinous murders, but because they are being exposed internationally for it.
And this is, very briefly, Robert, a rather new phenomenon. We hadn't really heard much about Australia's behaviour and its role in Afghanistan.
No, we hadn't up until this point. We heard quite a bit about British troops and what they'd done. But Australians have killed, and there's various human rights groups which have reported on this, have killed a lot of Afghan civilians, hundreds of them, in collateral damage due to their airstrikes that they've committed.
All right. We'll leave it and obviously continue to watch that story. Robert Inlakesh, thank you. And, of course, thank you for staying with us. Until next time, stay safe.
The Limelight.
According to Feeding America, the largest hunger relief organization in the U.S., more than 50 million people will experience food insecurity by the end of the year. Among U.S. children, the figure rises to 1 in 4. The group, which runs a network of some 200 food banks across the nation, says it distributed over 500 million meals last month alone, a 52% increase from an average pre-pandemic month. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Hunger Like They Have Never Seen It Before, U.S. Food Banks Struggle as 1 in 6 families with children don't have enough to eat. Here's the details of this article.